You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner's last book provoked long conversations by the water cooler. The new one has already inspired blog wars. The Freakonomics guys are back with Super Freakonomics, another serving of quirky questions and rogue economics. Their topics include the dangers of walking while drunk, the many influences of television on the culture, and their proposed solutions for global warming, among other things. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought them back to our show today. Hi.
Thank you.
Hi, Lenny.
You say that you lied about two things in your previous book. What were they?
Let's see if we can remember the two lies. One was that we said that the subtitle of that was about exploring the hidden side of everything, and we had to acknowledge in the second book that the first book didn't actually include everything. We were called to task for falsely promising.
That's false advertising. I'm very
false. We thought there was a difference between hyperbole and advertising, but that difference was apparently lost in our readership. What was the second line?
I think it was about a theme, that we really did have a theme, and the theme was incentives. And then you just talked about trying to get people to become members here, there were incentives in there. Incentives are everywhere, and that's really what our book is about, is how we using either financial incentives or social pressure. There's a little bit of that in the drive as well, to try to get people to do what you want.
Were you surprised by how successful that book became?
Yes,
completely.
Completely.
Totally.
I'm sure everybody writes a book hoping for a bestseller, but runaway bestseller?
We didn't really even hope for a bestseller. We were hoping for a quick hit, get out clean, take the money and run kind of approach, so Dubner could get back to his
That's the economist life. Talking. As the writer, I have a sort of ongoing relationship with publishers, so my feeling is a little bit different. But I think every writer... Look, there's always these articles about how there are these 10 books within any publishing house in a given year that kind of support the other 500 that are published. Well, I'm a writer. I live in New York. Most of my friends are writers. We are those 500. And it's a very weird economy, publishing. So it is kind of the blockbuster thing. And we thought we were the last people on earth to be eligible for that, certainly.
Well, you became another kind of Stephen King.
Yeah, now we're under the dome like him.
When we first signed the contract, I told my father I was going to write a book, and they'd give us a big advance. And my father said, "You've got to give the advance back." And I said, "Why?" He said, "It's immoral." Immoral? What do you mean? You can't steal the publisher's money like that. No one wants to read about the silly things you write about crack dealers and sumo wrestling. For the rest of my life, every time I go to a bookstore, there's going to be a pile of your books in the remainder's bin, and I'm going to have to buy all those books, so I don't feel ashamed for what you've done.
Gee, it's great to get the support of your parents. Your father's not an economist, obviously, because an economist would have told you to take the money and run.
Yeah, he's a doctor.
What is a cumulative advantage?
Well, the cumulative advantage that we write about in the introduction of this book is the one that we had of having written a book that people paid attention to. And so there's a few pieces of that. Obviously, readers will be looking forward to a book by the authors if it's a book that they like. But the one we're talking about here is our subject. So, Levitt is an academic economist who does really interesting empirical research from all different realms. And, most of the times I'd say you go looking for data, but sometimes the data would come to find him. And the stories that we write in Super Freakonomics and Freakonomics are these stories that marry empirical analysis with storytelling, with narratives, with characters, with people who do things. In this book, it's doctors, it's prostitutes, college students, whatever. And the cumulative advantage that we gained here was because of the first book, people came to us with stories. Now, the vast
including that high-end prostitute.
Yeah, wrote to Levitt one time. I'll let you tell the story how she came to you. It's not bad.
Yes, I got an email from a high-end call girl who said that a mutual acquaintance of ours had told her that I was working on a data collection project on prostitutes, and she asked me, she said she had a Palm Pilot that was full of all the information on all the clients she ever had, and she asked me whether that was the kind of data I was trying to collect. And I said, absolutely, that's exactly what I want. And she invited me to brunch. I explained to my wife that the prostitute had called me to come down and meet her for brunch. It wasn't going the other way. And we ended up developing a relationship, and not that kind of relationship. And she turned out to be a very intelligent woman and is now part of the book. And she offers a very different perspective. Most of the research I have on prostitutes are on street prostitutes that mm-hmm. you know, scrape out the worst kind of living imaginable, doing some of the most degrading acts you could believe in. And it's really an interesting counterpoint that we write about in the book of Superfreakonomics about how different it is to be a street prostitute and to be a high-end call girl.
And both of those stories we tell, you know, look, those topics are undeniably, you know, titillating, let's say, right? And people are going to be drawn.
That's why we're going to wait till later in the show to actually go into them in detail.
All right, granted. But here's what I'd say about that. The thing that we found most interesting also about prostitution is that we tell it within the framework of a chapter on the history of women's wages, essentially, which is a fascinating and huge story. So the prostitution is a big part of that chapter, but really the riddle is, the biggest riddle that we try to solve as well is why in this day and age in countries like ours do women who are commensurate with men still earn less, and try to get to the bottom of those problems.
You say that your method can be described not so much as economics than as the economic approach. What's the difference?
Yeah, I think a distinction that I make between what most people think about economics being, which is a subject matter, inflation rates, interest rates, macroeconomy, really that's not the heart of economics. The heart of economics is how – it's a worldview that economists share of how you answer questions. It involves data, going to data, the methods we have for data, the difference between correlation and causality.
But there are differences within the economic community, and it depends on whether you're a Keynesian or a follower of Milton Friedman as how you use these this data to explain human decision-making.
Well, I think even stronger than a difference between, say, a Friedman acolyte and Keynes is the break between what we call macroeconomics and microeconomics. So macroeconomics takes on the incredibly difficult, I would say near impossible task of trying to describe how the macroeconomy, how aggregate economy recessions work. Then there's another side of economics, which doesn't get as much play in the newspaper, but I think is actually much more important, which is human behavior, individual human behavior, why people make the decisions they make, how do you predict what decisions people will make. And that's what I do. I do microeconomics. But
some people say that that decision-making is rational, and others say it's irrational.
Well, I think rational is the wrong way to think about it. I think incentives are the right way to think about it, because rational implies that I can do very complicated calculations in my head, that I'm able to you know, do backward induction that's very complicated. But really, all you need for the economic approach is to know that people do what's in their own self-interest most of the time, and simply by, you know, altering the incentives or the context they're operating in, you can understand and predict what they'll do. And so, for instance, we've, you know, with one of my colleagues, John List, we've done a lot with experiments and trying to understand how you can use randomized experiments to really get to the heart of what's driving people's decision-making.
Well, it's often mentioned or pointed out that statistics can be used any way you want. So isn't it also a matter of how you interpret the statistics and whether you're even looking at the correct data?
Well, I certainly think it is true that in science and in social science, there is as much art and craft and skill as there is just simply science and actual, you know, hard and fast rules. And oftentimes, I think you hit on a very interesting one. Asking the right question is often the most important thing, that if you ask the right question and you use the data the right way, often the answer just reveals itself to you.
Hasn't it also been proven that people's behavior in experimental situations is different when they realize they're being watched? It's almost like a human version of the Heisenberg principle.
That's exactly right. And we write pretty much a chapter about that. And we kind of look at behavioral economics experiments in the lab over the course of several years that established this conventional wisdom about altruism. And it was very cleverly designed experimentation that seemed to lead to a conclusion that people are innately altruistic. And that really became a conventional wisdom that fed the way that we think about philanthropy, the way that we think about public policy. It became the way that we think about organ donation. If you think about it, if you have a bunch of the best economists in the world telling you that people are innately altruistic and they can prove it in
the
lab.
All right, you have a bunch of economists, not the best economists.
All right, if you have a bunch of economists who Levitt thinks are not the best, but some who are very highly rated by other people, then you'll feel that altruism is a kind of natural streak. then when you bring it into the real world, however, you don't always see it. So if you, for instance, I'm guessing you're having a pledge drive right now, right? I'm guessing that
you are part of it when you are on the takeaway, aren't you?
I probably am. They always block out that part of the studio. I'm guessing that your mailbox does not fill up with money as regularly during the non-pledge week months when there's not X, Y, and Z incentive offered. Now, does that mean that the people who give aren't charitable or altruistic? Not at all, but the incentives are there and they change behavior. So if you believe that people are innately altruistic to a certain degree, and let's say you want to have an organ donation policy that's built on altruism, it's going to fail. That's what's happened in this country. There's one country in the world that actually has not quite a market, but a payment system that's government funded and privately funded for organ donors. And that's Iran, believe it or not. And Iran is the one country in the world where if you are dying of some kind of kidney disease, that you can get a replacement from someone who steps up to surrender one and gets paid for it. Now, that's an idea. We deal with
a lot of people in this country would be horrified.
Horrified. And we talk
selling organs.
It is, and there are all these ideas that we look at in the book that are repugnant. And repugnance is actually, it's not an economic concept, but it's a very interesting one within the economic approach. And what's fascinating to me is to look at the history of repugnant ideas that cross the barrier. So life insurance, for instance, 200 years ago was considered a repugnant notion that someone could profit from the death of a loved one. And now, of course, it's, you know, we're thought crazy if we don't have it.
When people talk about repugnance with respect to selling organs, my rejoinder is always, isn't it repugnant to watch people die while on the waiting list? I mean, to me, that's far more repugnant than the idea that you would let someone who's willing to give up an organ, one of their two kidneys, which will probably have no impact whatsoever on their life, you compensate them. They're willing participants. The person who's getting the organ wants to have it, and yet somehow it's repugnant. You know, it's repugnant to prevent that from happening, but not from letting the person die this horrible death.
There's also this perception that a market for organs would unfairly punish poor people who would be driven to sell their organs, mm-hmm. who would be exploited.
The same sorts of people who sell blood. And we do have people selling blood to pay the rent or sometimes just to have a meal.
Exactly. Now, obviously, blood and organs are different. One's replaceable, one's not. But here's my point about the poor people argument is this. There are way more poor people on the list who are dying and who will never get an organ. If you're a person of means, there are other ways to get an organ. So I think that actually the argument that a market for organs would innately punish poor people, I think is almost entirely false. Again, these are hard arguments to have in part because you can't run experiments on them. And that's the point. Experiments can show you one thing, and the real world shows you something else. And what the real world has shown us with organ transplantation is depending on altruism is insufficient.
There was an article in Today's Times by Maureen Dowd in which was suggested that newspapers get involved in gambling, and a lot of people are horrified about that as well. I suspect you'd make similar arguments.
I think, look, there are papers in Britain that do it beautifully. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's ridiculous to think that journalism can be subsidized or paid for in only one way. And we're going to find that out in spades in the next 10 years. Already, we're seeing people who 10 years ago thought that foundation-sponsored journalism was not the right way to go are now finding out that foundation-sponsored journalism is a wonderful way to go. I think of one big difference in the UK and here, for instance. Here, if you look at, you know, papers in the UK often have a lot of gambling and are sponsored by it. In the UK, all the major sport, all the football teams, when you see their jerseys, it took me years to learn that Emirates was not the name of a soccer team. It was an airline. They're all wearing the name of the sponsor on the shirt. The NFL hasn't yet done it. At some point, they will. Newspapers haven't yet taken that step. Probably someday they will.
Your book has a number of controversial topics, from the relative safety of childcare seats to the relative dangers of walking while inebriated. But were you prepared for the outcry that your chapter on global warming inspired?
I think we were. I mean,
you knew about Michael Crichton, didn't you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, no, we're very different from Michael Crichton. Here's what we have to say about global warming. We start from the premise that it's very clear in the data that the Earth is getting warmer. We are not against the idea that it's human activity. I think it's always much harder to figure out why something happened than that it did happen. But that's really not our question at all. We take as given that the Earth is headed on a path where it is likely to be too hot, and we're going to want to do something to cool it down. And that's where we step in. We say, given the best data available, what do we think is the best way to cool the Earth? And presently, the conventional wisdom, it's by carbon mitigation, emitting less carbon. The problem with that solution is threefold. One, it's unbelievably expensive. The cheapest way we have to fuel our economy is to burn fossil fuels. Everything else would be more expensive, and the economists say it would cost trillions of dollars to make this transition. The second problem with reducing carbon is that it requires behavior change by 7 billion people. Everyone on the earth has to change the way they run their lives. That's very, very difficult to do. The third problem is even if we're successful, it will take 50 years before we feel the real benefits of it because carbon, once in the air, the half-life is 100 years. It takes a very, very long time to get these benefits. If the problem of global warming is as serious as we believe it to be, it is not enough to rely on that one solution, which is both uncertain and in the distance. So what we suggest instead is there are other possible solutions.
Including
geoengineering, which involve trying to fix problems sooner using technology, which has been a solution in so many other ways, which have the benefit of being fast, cheap, and completely reversible. So if anything goes wrong that we don't anticipate, we can undo it, and any effect of them will be gone within a year.
Now, some of these technologies frighten the living daylights out of people. Like, so one that we write about is called the strata shield, or a garden hose to the sky. And what it does is it replicates a volcanic explosion, essentially. So one of the most interesting pieces of scientific reasoning within this argument is if you look at the history of an explosion in the Philippines, Mount Pinatubo in 1991, which was a huge, one of the biggest explosions, volcanic explosions in 100 years. And what happens when a volcano is that big, it shoots its sulfur dioxide way into the sky. Instead of acid rain, it gets up into the uppermost level, into the stratosphere, not to the uppermost level, and it mixes with aerosol with water vapor there and forms a sort of aerosol cloud, and that actually cooled the Earth as a result for about 2 years. Now, you don't want to go around dynamiting volcanoes to cool the Earth to form this layer of sunscreen, but one proposal is to kind of figure out a way to inject just enough sulfate particle into the stratosphere to create this layer of sun shield. But some of the other solutions that are being proposed, if that freaks you out entirely, which it will a lot of people, there are other solutions being proposed that are about as green friendly as possible. For instance, increasing the cloud reflectivity of oceanic clouds. In other words, clouds are fantastic at cooling the Earth. In certain portions of the world, especially over the oceans, they have a hard time forming in a dense enough way to reflect a lot of sunlight. The reason is that there aren't enough nuclei to do so. So one method of geoengineering, which again is the gentlest form possible, would be to kind of find a way to kick up sea spray from the ocean, whereby those salt particles become those cloud condensation nuclei to increase reflectivity of clouds.
Part of the problem is that two of the scientists whose work you cite have repudiated.
No, that is completely.
Nathan Myhrvold and also Ken Caldera.
That could not be farther from the truth. Nathan Myhrvold published a blog post yesterday on our blog, which could not be more consistent. I mean, I don't even know how to respond to that. Nathan Myhrvold, if you had him on here sitting here, would say exactly what I'm saying, which is he could not be – his portrayal in there is completely consistent. Ken Caldera has certainly waffled more. At the same point, he has said that all of the facts we write about are true, and he had a chance to read the draft twice. I think that to even say that is completely counterintuitive. But before I get too upset, let's see.
I think to say it in the politest way possible.
Maybe we should take a break.
No, we can if you need to. I think to say it in the politest way possible. This is a controversial topic about which people get emotional, one, very much so.
You say it's almost religious.
Well, we do. We say that the movement to stop global warming has some of the components of a religion. And I'll tell you, we've certainly experienced that in the past few days. It feels very much like a fatwa has been levied. And as with fatwas, there's often a bizarre twisting and omission of fact. So I think the politest way to say it is, well, we knew that this would be controversial on the merits. What we're seeing is a sort of attack against the very idea. But like political attacks, they often bypass the actual facts and go straight to the messenger.
Well, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about other things, some of the other things that you discuss in this book. many of them quite provocative, and all of them a lot of fun to ponder. The book is Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. And we'll talk about that as well. And my guests are Stephen D. Levitt, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, recipient of the John Bates Clark Medal, and Stephen J. Dubner, former writer and editor at the New York Times Magazine, author of Turbulent Souls, Choosing My Religion, Confession of a Hero Worshipper, and also a regular contributor to our own show, The Takeaway.
Alas, I have no medals.
Well,
I don't have a medal.
But you might win a prize somewhere along the line. What do you think?
We
do
might win the Nobel Peace Prize for our work on real climate change.
That's possible. That's possible.
Well, anyway, we will take a little break.
If there's justice in the world, Lenny, that's
The book is published by HarperCollins. We'll be back right after this. We're back with Stephen D. Levitt, who is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and Stephen Dubner, who is a writer. They collaborated on the bestseller Freakonomics, and now we get their follow-up called Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. The book is published by HarperCollins. So why should a suicide bomber buy life insurance?
Well, I worked with a British bank, and we poured through tens of millions of data records, and much in the way that like a marketer pours through the data to try and figure out who's about to have a baby, right? If you ever had a baby, you know that, you know, ahead of time you get hundreds of letters in the mail of people who have somehow figured out you're having a baby, and if you go to, you know, a store and you buy paint and fix up things. They know you're building a house or fixing up a house, so they send you out. So we went to the data from a big bank. We tried to figure out what people were doing with their debit cards and what kind of accounts they had and whatnot to try to use data in a new way that's never been used in the fight against terrorism. And it turns out that one of the indicators we found that suggests you're not likely to be a terrorist is if you invest in life insurance with the bank. Because, of course, if you do a suicide bombing attack, then you're likely to be excluded from being paid off of a life insurance policy anyway. So there would be no point investing in the money. And so we say the reason you should buy life insurance if you're a suicide bomber is exactly because you'll throw people like us off the trail and we won't be able to catch you ahead of time.
But is anybody looking at life insurance policies to spot suicide bombers?
So this study that we write about in Super Freakonomics is exactly using these different pieces. You know, there's a story in the first book that was built on a study that Levitt had done with Brian Jacob, was it, the cheating teachers, which I met Levitt when I wrote a piece about him for the New York Times, and this was the study that he'd done that just convinced me that he was unusually good and creative and interesting. It was a way to catch cheating teachers by looking just at the test scores of their kids, not even at the actual score sheets, but just the data from it. And they thought, and so the reasoning there was, if I'm a teacher whose students are doing poorly, and now we've got No Child Left Behind, and I need them to do less poorly or I get in trouble. Now the teachers had incentives to help the kids cheat, which they hadn't had before. What would I do if I wanted to help those kids cheat? So Levitt and Brian Jacob devised a number of things to look for, a number of patterns to look for. For instance, if you get a bunch of answers right in a row, but before you'd only gotten one right here and there, that looks like maybe the teacher's actually erasing the incorrect answers and filling in the correct ones. If you, for instance, get a bunch of hard answers right, a bunch of easy ones wrong, and so on and so on. And from this, an algorithm was written that did a really good job of identifying the cheating teachers. It's what he did now is very similar with prospective terrorists.
Now, the conventional wisdom is that terrorists come from poor families and are poor themselves, but that turns out not to be true. What is the incentive for somebody who is well-educated to become a terrorist and blow him or herself up?
You know, that's a question, honestly, that you'd have to ask the terrorists. I mean, one thing that we try to do is we focus a little bit more on the what than the why. Sometimes we know the why, and if we can argue the why convincingly with some data, then we'll make it. If we don't know it, we don't. So what we do know is that the data show that terrorists are much counter to conventional wisdom. We think of crime and violent crime in particular. That's much more common among lower socioeconomic classes. Terrorism, however, is not. Terrorists these days are not. If you look at revolutionaries from the past, we compile this list of kind of famous revolutionaries. All of them were from kind of upper middle or upper class families, well educated, and so on. But when you don't know,
and the 9/11 killers or whatever we want to call them, they were all from middle and upper class families.
They were. So then you have to ask the question: what is a terrorist trying to achieve? And that's a question that we're not really that well equipped to ask. You know, there's a thing in the book, pretty brief, where we talk about TV and crime, the relationship between TV and crime, which I'll let Levitt talk about the particulars of it. But if you can make an argument that something is happening, almost certainly, from the data, then we make that argument. We can't really say why TV had the effect on crime that it did.
What effect does it have on crime?
Well, what we see, in fact, is a strong positive relationship between the introduction of TV and crime. And let me make clear, we're not talking about the usual arguments people make about TV violence and linking exposure to violence with crime. We're talking about literally the introduction of TV. And so one of the beautiful things from an economist's perspective about the way TV got introduced in the United States is that it was done in a very staggered fashion, that places like New York City got TV very early, and then between World War II and other problems with technology, there were big breaks in between when TV came to other areas. What we see is that there was, of course, this unbelievable increase in crime in the 1960s, like a quadrupling or even quintupling of crime in the 1960s. And it looks that coincides quite well with the introduction of TV, not just the time series data, but even where crime went up and who it went up for. So kids who were born just a few years earlier, before they got TV in the area, ended up being much less criminal than people who were born after TV came around.
So can we blame I Love Lucy and Father Knows Best?
We actually pinned it on Leave It to Beaver, to be honest. And also the Andy Griffith Show. One hypothesis, almost certainly not true, is that one of the reasons that TV led to more crime was that by seeing such a bumbling representation of police on TV, people, potential criminals, had less fear of the consequences that might come to them.
Now, Gail Collins is coming on our second hour and talking about how the world has changed for women since 1960. Is there still an economic penalty for being a woman?
There is, a surprisingly strong one. So it depends which kinds of women and which kinds of men you're comparing and so on. But we kind of go from top to bottom, and we try to look at the reasons for this wage penalty. So some of the most compelling evidence that there is a penalty comes from researchers including Larry Katz and Claudia Golden, who look at a few different comparisons. They look at kind of high-achieving women versus high-achieving men from the same universities even. They look at MBA graduates from the same university and try to isolate the factors that lead to women having lower wages. Now, there are some that we know we've talked about a whole lot. Women tend to do more family duty than men. They tend to withdraw from the workforce more voluntarily than men, so on. But that said, it doesn't explain it all. There are also some discriminations, which seem to be, all in all, these days in this setting, fairly minor. So there are some very marginal ones. Bad teeth, for instance. Women are penalized more in the labor market for having bad teeth than are men. Overweight, the same thing. Women are penalized more than men. But that said, the most compelling, surprising piece of this, I think, shows that really a lot of the penalty is kind of self-imposed, which is to say that women seem to not be as incentivized by wage as men are. Now, that's a somewhat speculative claim, but we try to show the ways in which we arrive at that. But it seems to be that just as women are partial to being the ones to take on more duty for the family and children, men seem to be partial for earning more money.
So when a woman spends a lot of money to get an MBA, is she spending her money poorly?
This might sound wrong over the radio, but women do get a return on their investment in terms of their careers. But if you look at the data, believe it or not, one of the biggest returns to a woman from getting an MBA is the fact that women who get MBAs marry very rich men who also have gotten MBAs, and they end up indirectly being part of a very wealthy family. So one of the benefits of going to get the MBA is actually the increase in the wealth of the person you'll marry.
And then if that woman stops working, then what you're looking at in economic terms is this kind of, you know, parked or dormant human capital. Here's this woman who spent all this time achieving these skills that could help her make a lot of money and not using them at all.
Well, there are also skills that can help you raise children, too. I think people often forget that the job of raising children is an incredibly important, valuable one that does benefit from having human capital.
And harder than what we do, which is why we're sitting here.
did your study of prostitution grow out of thinking about women and their earning power? Because you say that in the 1910s, one out of every 10 women was a prostitute. That's an incredible amount.
I don't think that's right. Not one out of every 10. One out of every 50, I think. I think that
it's
might be a typo.
Women,
in the cohort of the 20s, I think it was one out of 45 or one out of 50. I know it wasn't one out of 10. But yeah, it was part of the interesting thing about that was that 100 years ago, the wage of a prostitute, even a low-level street prostitute, was so high relative to the wage of a shop. Let's say you were a shop girl, 22 years old, living in Chicago. You could the amount that you could make working as a shop girl, you could make about 10 or 20 times that amount working as a street prostitute. So really, anything we write about really in the book is about what are the incentives, how do incentives change behavior.
But being a prostitute has turned into, and it always was probably a lousy job, but now it is simply the worst job in America. And the thing that has really killed prostitution more than anything else, the worst competition it had, was a sexual revolution. When you've got competitors who are willing to give sex away for free, it really hurts the people who are trying to get others to pay for it.
You say that the higher the price for a call girl, the less sex the client is likely to want to engage in.
Well, this is based on, so we tell that we have a...
Elliot Spitzer spent a fortune.
He did spend a fortune, yes. We don't know the particulars of his hour-by-hour activity, but... there are two prostitution stories we tell in the book. One is about these kind of very low-income street-level prostitutes in Chicago whose lives are just incredibly sad and difficult. And most of them are drug addicts, and it's a life that is very hard to imagine, and you certainly wouldn't wish on anyone. And yet they do it. So we try to explore the reasons why they do it and what the wage is. On the other end, we tell a story of a very high-end call girl. Now, this is not an empirical study with 200 high-end call girls. It's one.
Yeah, but Allie, who got in touch with you.
Allie, who got in touch with us. And what we found, what she found, was that when she was charging her opening rate, about $300 an hour, that was a lot of money for her to be making. But for the men who are willing to buy prostitution, it wasn't really that much. And it was a different kind of clientele, and mostly she got a lot of one-hour clients. When she started charging more, $400 and $500 an hour, it attracted a different kind of clientele where often it was someone who wanted to spend the night, have dinner, a theater show, and then maybe some sex, but often even not some sex. And like you said, the more she was getting paid, the less actual sex.
It's almost like being a geisha because because it's assumed that if you're charging that much money, you're intelligent, you have other skills. You can engage in interesting conversation.
Absolutely. The way I think about Allie, the high-end prostitute in our book, is really she had a choice. She could either be a trophy wife to one man, or she could be a high-end call girl, which essentially makes her a trophy wife to 100 different men. And that is really, I think, the role that she serves. She's like the perfect wife to have for 2 hours. She's beautiful. She's fun. She takes care of you in sexual ways and others. But she's just chosen to do it for 100 different
now,
people.
I want to address it because we don't have a lot of time. One of the other controversial things in there, why is it more dangerous to walk drunk than to drive drunk?
Well, again, the why is why is in the numbers. And if you look at the numbers, there are some caveats here. I should state the caveats up front. This is on a per-mile basis, okay? So what we look at is, let's say you go to a friend's party and you drink too much and you live a mile away and you decide, I'm too drunk to drive home. So I'm going to do the smart thing. I'm going to walk home. It turns out that if you look at that comparison, that you're about 8 times more likely to die than if you drive home. In other words, walking drunk in that circumstance is about 8 times more dangerous.
Why are you going to walk across the street?
If you look at the NHTSA data, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration data on traffic fatalities overall, then you look at the alcohol-related traffic fatalities, which are about 13,000 per year out of about 40,000. Then within those, you look at the pedestrian deaths, where the pedestrian was drunk. 1,000 of those pedestrian deaths each year. So people get drunk and they do things like step off the curb into a taxi. They try to make a mad dash across a highway, and sometimes they lie down on a country road to take a nap, and it turns out to be... Now, here's the thing. You can't kill someone else while walking drunk, whereas a drunk driver can. So obviously we're not saying, hey, don't walk drunk, but it's okay to drive. Obviously that's not a solution. The solution is to, do the taxi.
Even when you take into account, though, the deaths of other people when you are driving, it is still 5 times as many people will die on average, if you get behind the wheel, if you walk, as if you get behind the wheel.
Yeah. So the message isn't that driving drunk is any less bad than it is, and we show how bad it is. It's just that walking drunk is actually very bad.
Now, one of the other things that really surprised me was that Nobel Prize winners will live longer than other people. Did they live longer than nominees?
Yeah.
Or did...
There were a couple studies that, again, do a very good job of looking at kind of apples to apples. So Nobel Prize winners live, I think it was about a year and a half longer than those who were, you know, finalists, essentially. The same thing for Baseball Hall of Fame. So if you're a great ball player and you have been nominated for the Hall of Fame, or you almost get there, that there's something about, and again, the why is very hard to say. We could speculate pretty easily that you get some self-esteem. But in the case of the Nobel Prize, for instance, it doesn't have to do with the extra medical care that the bonus that the prize is buying you. It seems to have to do with status. You know, status is an important piece of life. It's interesting. Economics is going into all these realms lately, including the personal, and that's kind of one of them.
And you say the estate tax has an effect on the timing of people's deaths.
It's interesting because right now the U.S. estate tax is in for all kinds of bumps in the next few years. But a nice Australian study showed that when an estate tax was abolished, that at the end of the year, all kinds of people were kind of hanging on, right? Whether it was that their grown children were keeping them alive in the hospital longer, because if they could die after January 1, there'd be more money coming down the pike. Incentives are everywhere.
Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Symphony Space. That's at Broadway at 95th Street. For more information about tickets, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Their book, their latest book, is called Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. It's published by HarperCollins. And it's been a great pleasure talking with you. We didn't cover everything. Well, I mean, you admit that you didn't cover everything, but we didn't even cover some of the more interesting things in this book. We just didn't have enough time.
Well, thanks for having us very much, Ella.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.